Mormon Stories Podcast takes a ton of work and depends solely upon listener support. To keep this program alive, please consider a donation today at mormonstories.org.
Wow, okay, so take us back a little bit to before Thomas was born, I guess. Was there anything noteworthy or unusual about the pregnancy other than that you already had six kids? Like, that's noteworthy to me. That's, like, salute-worthy for me. Did it feel like there was anything unusual about it?
Yeah. In fact, I don't think this had anything to do with him having Down syndrome. I think it was because it was my seventh pregnancy. But it was by far my hardest pregnancy. I was exhausted beyond exhaustion. You know, those first that first trimester, a lot of women just get this bone deep fatigue. Mm-hmm. And I had had that with all of my pregnancies, but with Thomas it was just exponentially more, where I felt my body just struggling. Like, I could hear my own body fighting to create this new body and keep myself, you know, awake and alive and moving at the same time.
Wow.
And I, in fact, I had a really strong impression early on in the pregnancy when I was kind of berating myself for not being able to do anything. You know, I couldn't even walk up the stairs without pausing to rest several times. And the thought that just kind of came to me, it was like myself talking to myself. And the message was, okay, we can grow this baby as long as we don't have to do anything else. Hmm. And that's kind of how it was throughout the pregnancy. I was very limited in my day-to-day functioning. I wasn't ill, you know, there wasn't anything wrong per se, but I was, I just had very, very little to offer beyond breathing, you know, staying alive. And then I went into labor very early.
Okay, yeah. How many weeks along were you?
I was 28 weeks when my labor started. And that was just terrifying. Probably one of the scariest things, absolutely one of the scariest things that's ever happened to me. I was sitting on a bench with my neighbor because I was so early on that and my water hadn't broken, and so part of me was kind of hoping it was just false labor. And so instead of having Reed take me to the hospital, I had my neighbor take me so Reed could stay home with all the other kids. And we were sitting on this bench out next to the nurse's station, and I was having these contractions. And I felt, like, when I felt my uterus contract, I was feeling that same oxytocin letdown, like when you're breastfeeding and your milk lets down. Mm-hmm. There's that certain trigger, that hormonal trigger in your body. Mm-hmm. I was feeling that with every contraction. Mm-hmm. And I knew that I was actually in labor, and I was just so terrified. It was just way too early. It was 3 months early. Mm-hmm. Thankfully, they were able to stop my labor for 2 weeks. I was in the hospital on bed rest for 2 weeks before my water broke and Thomas was born that night.
So you were already sort of extra exhausted when he was born.
Yeah, and I knew that this was the last baby I was going to have.
Okay.
In fact, before we even knew he had Down syndrome, I knew that I was not going to ever have another baby.
Okay. You just had a sense, this is going to be our family.
Yeah, when they pulled him out, and, you know, I never got to see him or hold him before they kind of passed him through the window into the newborn ICU. And as soon as he left my body, I just started hysterically crying and just absolutely knew that my body could never go through that again. Absolutely not.
Okay. Yeah, so that didn't have anything to do with him having Down syndrome, because you didn't know that at that point.
Right, yeah.
Okay. So we'll just sort of walk us through finding out that he had Down syndrome.
Okay. We had been extremely frightened and tense about the very high possibility that the baby would be born with severe respiratory issues. So we had been kind of mentally preparing ourselves for that. And our sixth baby had been born with premature lungs, and we'd had a really scary experience with him. So we were kind of having all these flashbacks and a lot of really strong fear about what the baby's condition might be when he's born. And so when that period of time when they had him in the NICU being evaluated, and Reed and I were still in the birthing room just waiting, and I was just weeping uncontrollably and shaking and unable to calm down at all. What we were expecting was for them to, you know, slide open this, we called it the drive-through window, because it was exactly like a drive-through window, to slide open this window between the birthing room and the NICU and to give us some pretty dire news about the baby's health.
Okay.
Specifically his respiratory health. And so when the nurse slid open the window, you know, Reed and I were both extremely tense and just kind of bracing ourselves. And the nurse, to our great surprise, smiled and told us his Apgar scores, which were tremendous, and said that he was breathing room air on his own. They didn't even have a nasal cannula with oxygen on him at that point, although he ended up needing it shortly thereafter. But at the very start, his respiration was normal enough that they weren't doing any sort of support for his breathing. And Reed and I were so amazed and just so grateful and just relieved. It's like this huge burden had been lifted, and we were just looked at each other and kind of smiled and started to laugh a little and just could not believe our good luck. And that was the mood that we were in. Just starting to kind of downshift from this whole crisis that had been going on for several weeks, when these two doctors came into the birthing room and stood by the foot of my bed. And I knew right away that something was wrong, because it was two doctors and not just one. And they had these very solemn looks on their faces. And they said, we believe your son has Down syndrome. And Reed and I just, you know, there's just the shock, you know, the words come out of their mouth and kind of float around the room, you know, and it's completely surreal to hear doctors say that about your child. Mm-hmm. I don't think either one of us felt anything, even the barest beginnings of any reaction to that for a few hours, and it took days for it to really start to sink in, and it took months for it to really, really start to sink in as far as the implications for the rest of our lives. Mm-hmm. It was a gradual kind of process of absorbing this news. And that initial period of shock, I was really hopeful that I was going to really be okay and not fall apart. You know, I was kind of proud of myself and thinking, oh, I'm doing really well. You know, I'm okay. I'm fine. And we went to sleep that night, like at 3 or 4 in the morning, just still in this total state of denial. You know, we had gone to see Thomas. We had held it. I had held him for a few minutes and everything. So it's not like we hadn't seen him and touched him, but I don't think for either of us we were really acknowledging, we weren't able to really acknowledge what we had been told until we woke up the next morning. And then that was kind of like, you know, the universe falling apart.
Mm-hmm.
Just all of a sudden you open your eyes and you remember what happened the night before, and it just hits you that there is this reality that you do not want. You did not ask for, you do not want to have to deal with, and you'd have no choice, you know. Mm-hmm. It's there, and you have to deal with it. You have to wade through it. And that was a really hard thing to wake up to. Mm-hmm. I'll put it that way.
So, I mean, did you have, I'm assuming, you know, I've had three kids, people calling, or you sort of had people that you felt like you needed to call and share the news with?
I mean, so
what did you guys do? What did you do with that? Did you avoid it? I don't know.
Yeah, that's a good question. I called my mother first because she had been home with the other kids all night waiting to hear. She didn't even know the baby had been born yet. We didn't call her right after he was born. And so she was waiting to hear the news. So I called her. And, you know, the first thing I told her is, okay, Thomas has been born, and I was giving her kind of a health report. That was her first questions were, you know, how is he doing? How's his health? And she, as well, was so relieved by this good news that as far as his lungs were concerned, he was doing okay. And so then I had to tell her the second piece of news and you know, tell her about his diagnosis. And it was so difficult. It was so difficult to say those words. It's like every one of them weighed 1,000 pounds just stuck in my mouth. And to say it out loud was a really difficult thing to do. Mm-hmm. It got somewhat easier with repetition. But for those first couple of days, every time I had to tell somebody, it was kind of agony all over again.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so talk to us a little bit about talking to your kids, your older kids, about that.
Well, we had a conversation with the geneticist when Thomas was still, you know, very, very newborn. And the geneticist, we had not done the chromosomal karyotype test yet. And the geneticist was telling us, okay, we're going to order this blood test. But, you know, I'm not so sure. I'm not convinced that he has Down syndrome. Mm. And Reed and I were sitting there kind of looking at each other like, what? And he said, you know, it's not a done deal yet. And so we did not want to tell the children until we knew for sure what the diagnosis was. Mm-hmm. So Thomas was a few days old when we told them, and we had plans to kind of tell them all together in like this family council meeting where we would all sit and say just the right things, and it was all just going to work out wonderfully somehow. And I was preparing for that. I was reading all of this, the handouts and the pamphlets and the other information the hospital sent me home with. I was reading all that, searching for something that would help me tell my kids what had just happened in our family. And I did not know what to do. I wasn't sure how to frame it. I didn't know what to say. I very much wanted to say the encouraging Mormon mom kind of things about what a blessing this was, and Heavenly Father was blessing us, and we were just so blessed, and blessed, 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 blessed. But that's not how I felt, and mm-hmm. I didn't know whether to lie, you know, or what to do. And at that point, my son Ben came in the room, and he saw what I was reading. I kind of tried to hide it, but I was pumping breast milk at the time, and, you know, that kind of limits
yes.
your ability to...
Your movement.
That's right. And he saw what I was reading, and, you know, read the headings on one of the pamphlets, and just said, why are you reading this?
How old was he at the time?
He was, he was 11.
Okay.
He was 11, and he was, he's an extremely emotionally sensitive kid, and just the look on his face when I told him, Ben, Thomas has Down syndrome. You know, this is when we had gotten the phone call from the geneticist saying, yes, he does have Down syndrome for sure. I forgot to tell you that part. And Ben, you might remember this from the book. Ben was, he was so devastated. And he wanted so much to not be devastated. Mm. And that's exactly exactly how I felt myself. It was this mix of grief and then a rejection of your own grief. You did not want to be grieving. You know, you're ashamed of yourself for feeling the way that you feel. And so it's not just the pain of the grief itself, but also this kind of meta level reaction to your feelings, your feelings about your feelings. And he was so stuck. I could see it in his eyes where he wanted to be brave. He wanted to be mature. He wanted to say the right things, but he was shaking. And he just said, "Mom, I'm so sorry, but I would rather not have a retarded brother. I'm so sorry, but I would rather not." And that's exactly how I felt too. You know, I would rather not have this child, and I am so sorry that that's how I feel about it. It was like this terrible realization that that in my heart of hearts, I really did think and feel and believe things about disabled people, which now included my own son, that I was ashamed of. It was awful to have to look that straight in the face and confront my own fears, insecurities, my prejudices, my biases, my immaturity, basically.
But so were you able to tell him, you know, I know what you mean, or what did you do with that at that point? Were you still trying to be stoic? Because, like,
yes.
As an outsider, I can think that I would be able to say, oh, I feel like that too. But then I'm thinking, oh, I probably wouldn't want to my own kid to own up to that either.
It was, it's definitely something we could do down the road a bit. You know, we could very much validate their emotions in a very calm way. But in the moment, my own distress was so overwhelming, I was just barely keeping it under the surface so that I could, you know, be a somewhat normal mom to my kids and they wouldn't be wondering what was wrong with me. I was worried that if I acknowledged, if I opened the door on that even just a little bit, it would all just flow out and drown my kid who needed me to be supportive of him somehow. And so, you know, I put my arm around him and hugged him and tried to console him and told him that someday we would look back on that very day, that very moment, and wonder why we ever cried about it. And I did believe that that was true. I did believe that at some point we would probably look back from a very different perspective and say, wow, we were so sad about Thomas's diagnosis, but, you know, now we know so much more than we did then, and we don't feel the same way, quite the same way that we did before. But as far as acknowledging my own emotional agony, I couldn't do it for a long time with my kids.
Okay, so what was it like when they, how long was he in the hospital before he could come home?
He was in the hospital for 6 weeks.
Okay, and so then what was it like when he came home?
Oh, it was overwhelming. It was chaotic. Reed's parents had been in town for 3 weeks. Well, my mom was in town for the first few weeks, and then Reed's parents came when she had to go home. And so the whole time Thomas was in the hospital, we had grandparents here at the house, you know, running the household on our behalf, taking care of the kids. But they had to go home right before Thomas was released. And so, you know, in some ways it's like the end of the crisis. You know, he's getting out of the hospital, and it seems like this is such a big turning point. But in a way, the crisis is just beginning, because when you're in the hospital, it's a very controlled environment, and your responsibilities are really limited, and you're also able to separate that piece of your life from the rest of your life at home. And to kind of have those two worlds collide was, oh man, I don't even think I know a word for it. It was beyond overwhelming. It was to the point that I had to shut down emotionally, pretty much completely, and just be like in this kind of robotic survival mode in order to just be able to keep putting one foot in front of the other. I couldn't feel anything. I couldn't let myself feel anything
Okay.
for a long time.
So how would you say that it was, or would you say it was the same as having when you brought your other children home? I mean, that to me was overwhelming and hard. And yeah. My kids didn't have any particular health problems. So
yeah.
Was it the same as in some ways, or was it just totally different?
There were aspects of it that were very much the same. In a way, it felt a lot like bringing my first baby home when I had absolutely no clue how to take care of a baby.
Okay.
And that was just terrifying. And I felt the same way about bringing Thomas home. I didn't know how to take care of him.
Mm-hmm.
I was afraid to get him out of his car seat when he woke up and kind of started crying a little, and I knew I had to pick him up and start taking care of him. And I was terrified to pick up my own kid. And I had, it was my seventh kid. I could take care of babies, half asleep or...
Right.
And it had just been something that I'd grown so accustomed to. But he was, starting over, all over again.
Okay.
As far as my sense of insecurity. And we had medical issues, which complicated things. He came home with a nasal gastric tube, up his nose, down into his stomach. That was how we gave him his feedings. We had to shoot breast milk up his nose with a syringe to feed him. And he also needed supplemental oxygen for about 3 months at home. And so we had this bassinet set up by the side of my bed, and there were these 5-foot-tall oxygen tanks, strategically positioned behind the bassinet. And on my bedside table was the hospital breast pump and the oxygen monitor, which sounded its alarm, day and night with the slightest fluctuation in Thomas's blood oxygen saturation, it would sound an alarm. And it was very much the same and yet utterly different than all the other homecomings that we had.
Mm-hmm.
And I look back, describing it right now, I look back, I'm just sitting here kind of shaking my head and just, I can't believe that we lived through that.
Wow.
But we did, you just do.
Right.
Either you die or you live through it. And since we didn't die, we lived through it.
Mm-hmm. Well, so you talk in the book too about sort of, about faith issues and God's hand in all this. But I'm just thinking that, or wondering whether at that time you were either feeling like, oh, I'm relying on my belief in God to sustain me, or I mean, and these are two ends of the spectrum, and I'm sure there's lots of gray, but it seems like when people have a crisis like that, they either do that, they cling to, and I don't use the word cling in a negative way, they rely on their belief in God to help them make sense of it and to sustain them, or they reject it because it's kind of like they can't, their idea of God won't allow for this terrible thing to have happened to them. Does that make sense?
Yep.
So does that seem like an appropriate characterization, or would you say that it was more complex than that, or that is not accurate?
I would say that I felt both of those ways at the same time.
Okay.
And that was, actually, if I had to pick one aspect of that first 6 months that was the most difficult, it would be the experience of having completely opposite, seemingly mutually exclusive thoughts and feelings and beliefs simultaneously.
Okay.
Where, I've read 2 Nephi, dozens of times and could quote you all the scriptures about the importance of opposition, but I kind of understood opposition as a principle to refer to how we fluctuate between opposites, between contradicting realities that, you can feel, you can have mixed feelings about something, but you're going to feel happy about it at one point, and then you might feel sad about it the next day or the next hour. What I had never consciously experienced before was feeling both at the same time. Mm-hmm. Feeling contradicting emotions, believing completely opposite truths about a given situation simultaneously. I don't know how else to describe it, but I really wondered if I was losing my mind.
Mm-hmm.
I really thought that there was something wrong with me, and I kept trying to figure out which of the two was real. Mm-hmm. You know, is it really this way or is it really that way? Do I really feel this way? Do I really believe this or do I believe that? And it took a good half a year before I started to realize that they were both true at once, equally okay. true. And so as far as regarding my faith, it totally turned over the apple cart, very much so. At the same time, there were still beliefs that I was hanging on to. And I at that time still found ultimately a degree of comfort in the idea that God had planned all of this for our ultimate good and our well-being, and that somehow it was all going to be okay.
Okay.
At the same time, I really was angry and hurt that God had purposefully given me an experience that was exposing all of my weaknesses and flaws and limitations. It's like God's supposed to be this great guy who helps you out, and instead he's like punching you on your bruised arm over and over and over again. And it's like I felt like he was setting me up to fail. Mm. Like he had given me this child, and he was basically asking me to do the impossible. He was asking me to love a child that I couldn't truly love, and that I was going to, this was a test that I was going to utterly fail, and that he was setting me up. You know, as irrational as that sounds, that's mm-hmm. that's how I felt. Mm-hmm. So I still believed that he was pulling the puppet strings. I was just starting to really resent the moves that he was making mm-hmm. in my life at the moment. And mm-hmm. by the end of that first year, that changed very much, where God was off the hook for the most part, where I no longer believed that he had foreordained this experience for me or predetermined it, that it was not fated. It was not an inevitable thing, that he was not micromanaging my life, my family. And that was an extreme relief to be able to let go of holding God responsible for everything that happens in life.
Uh-huh. That was liberating.
Very much so. Because when you believe he's responsible, then you have to reconcile all of these realities with a loving God. You know, you have to figure out, well, okay, so why did he let this happen? You know, if he's in charge and everything that happens is his will, then that means he wanted this and that and the other thing to happen. And you have to do these mental gymnastics to reconcile that within yourself. And it's incredibly painful. And when something happens to you that you can no longer reconcile, that's when that belief kind of breaks down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what I'm hearing, I feel like anyway, you say sort of over and over is that, yeah, we crave these sort of neat and tidy explanations and solutions.
Yeah.
And that seems like a big sort of maybe lesson or takeaway message, at least from my interactions with you and from reading the book, is that it's actually a lot more complicated, and that we want to control things that we can't control, or we want to think that God is controlling things when maybe it's not exactly the way we thought. You know, I mean, it just feels like a much more sort of universal, or like it's life is just lots more messier than we would like to admit.
Yeah, I think messier and simpler at the same time, you know?
Okay,
I think that when you let go of all of these safety measures that you think are necessary, and that requires so much energy and focus to maintain, you know, like the thought that if you believe that your children have to be a certain way in order for them to be happy and you to be happy, you're going to invest a whole lot of yourself in making that happen because you're driven by fear. You're terrified that it's not going to happen, and you're going to do everything you can to make it happen. And when you let go and you realize that A, you can't make it happen, and B, you don't even want to make it happen, because if you make something happen, you're taking it away from the person who's in charge of themselves, mm-hmm. you free up all of this obsession, all of this focus on controlling what can't be controlled and what shouldn't be controlled. Mm-hmm. And you're able to kind of relax and surrender and live according to what is actually true rather than the truth you feel like you have to create through your own determination and hard work. Mm-hmm. And that's... it's an enormous relief. It's frightening to realize, oh my gosh, you know, I'm not holding the reins really after all. But it's also, I have found it to be extremely liberating and would never go back to the old way of thinking.
Wow. That's powerful. Well, I'm going to tell you just one story and then I'll ask you some questions about when Thomas was born and stuff. So I read your book a few weeks ago. And I was thinking, as I was reading all that stuff about your kind of perception, your experience with your kids, that was sort of like feeling like, ooh, the guilty taketh the truth to be hard. last week, or I guess it was the week before, we ended school here. And I had this class I was doing, so I couldn't go to my oldest daughter, the award ceremony at her school. But they had sent us a letter saying that she was going to get an award, as she always does. I mean, every year for her, it's actually kind of embarrassing to me to go. I mean, I'm happy for her, but at the same time, I'm kind of thinking, gee, like, was there any meeting where you guys sat around and said, okay, well, she's already gotten four things, so, like, let's share the love? I mean, it's sort of like... cringeworthy for me.
Yeah.
But I couldn't go, which was another, like, mom juggling moment. I felt really bad, but my husband went. And he sent me a text and told me that her and this other girl that's the son of some friends of ours won, like, the best seventh grade this, the best seventh grade this, the best that, all those things. The two of them sort of went back and forth and won all of those things. And so he was saying, oh, I was really proud of her, whatever. And I was thinking of, oh, I'm proud of her too, but I had, like, your book in the back of my mind thinking, oh, and why are we so proud because she's getting all those things, you know? And my husband said, well, I was telling them, these friends of ours, that we should go out to eat and celebrate. And my husband likes to go out to eat, so he's, you know, it doesn't take much to have an excuse for him to want to go out to eat. But he told me that, and I said, well, I'm happy to do that, but I have two thoughts. One, our other two kids had, like, that was Wednesday, and then one kid was going to have their award ceremony on Thursday and the other one on Friday. And I knew they were going to get things too. I mean, that maybe just sounds totally arrogant, but that I just knew they would. And mm-hmm. I said, so we either need to go out three times, or we need to just wait until the weekend and go out once. And I said, and actually, and I was totally thinking of your book, I said, we probably ought to just say, we're going to go out to eat and say, you guys had such a great school year. I'm like, because what would we do if we had a kid? Like, we can't say we're going to go out to eat because Kennedy got seven awards at school. Because then what if the other kids don't? Or what if they start counting? Or then you have this weird competitive thing between kids. And then my husband was like, you know, you're right. That's a, like, so there's that tension between me wanting to feel like, well, I want to congratulate her and tell her that I'm proud of her. But then also thinking, but I want her to know that I'm proud of her for other things or just for who she is. And not only because she sort of cashed in at school, you know. It was kind of an embarrassing moment for me that I realized that that's sort of the way we've set it up in our minds. We're so proud of you. And then I was like, okay, well, let's just say school's over. And so everybody went and had a hamburger, you know, but it wasn't, we just changed in our minds what the purpose of it was.
Yeah.
So I was glad to have read your book and thought, oh yeah, that hit right. That hit right close to home.
It's a complicated thing. You know, there are always these two poles that you're trying to find kind of a delicate balance in between. And one is that you want to encourage and praise and congratulate your children for what they accomplish. And the other is that you don't want to send the message that their value increases commensurately with their accomplishments and that your love for them shifts according to their accomplishments. I think really the parents who truly believe that their children's academic achievements are not the only thing that matters in life will successfully send those messages to their kids. Mm-hmm. I think those of us who are in trouble are those of us who pretend like other things are more important, but our true beliefs leak out. They kind of leak out into everything we do because our kids kind of subconsciously absorb what our true values are based on our behavior. And, you know, what can you do? All you can do is to do the best that you can do.
Right. Yeah. Well, a couple months ago, I came home from work, and our kids had like their It's the TACS test here. There are several days of, you know, standardized testing. And my middle daughter, who's in the fourth grade, said, "Mom, oh my gosh, I did that thing today that you told me absolutely never, ever to do." And I was thinking, oh, this is not good. Like, what if I told her not ever to do? She's only 10. So I was like, did she say crap or stupid? Or, I don't know that I've told her that, but it sounded sort of dire, you know? And I said, do I want to hear this? And she said, yes. And I'm like thinking, okay, I hope. Because, like, we've told her things, like, my husband is better than I am at this, but he'll tell him things like, you know, oh, you got an 82 on something? That's great. It's good for you to miss some things because now you know you need to learn, you know, and they'll be upset. They can't get a B on something, you know? They're kind of uptight. But so he's told them before, the only thing you're going to get in big trouble with us for is if you are mean to a kid. If we find out that you've been mean or unkind, you're going to be in big trouble. Or if it's a sin of omission. So maybe you're not mean, but you still are, like, excluding another kid or whatever, you know? And we'll be disappointed in you if you sell yourself short. Otherwise, you know, we just want you to be happy. That's what we try to tell them anyway. So she said, well, I had already done all the math questions on my test 2 times. And I thought and thought I should go over and check my answers and do them all a 3rd time.
Oh, geez.
And she said, and then I just wanted to read my book. So I just turned in my test. And so, remember when you told me that I shouldn't sell myself short? I think I sold myself short.
Oh, no!
I just started laughing, and I was like, wow, we're dealing with big troubles over here in the Olson-Beal family. Like, my daughter. I was like, Maren, I think you're good. I think you definitely needed to go and read your Lemony Snicket book, and I think, you know, you'd already done the math questions twice, you know. But, yeah. But then they were also happy because they came home with their test scores, which they give them out at school, which I find just totally bizarre and unconscionable. And they had missed 1 question. So she was saying, I only missed 1 question. And then I was in that boat again where I was thinking, okay, so they want me to say, good, I'm so proud of you.
Yeah.
So I want to honor that. At the same time, I'm also kind of thinking, I don't even care about that test because I think it's crazy, you know.
Yeah.
So it's hard to know how to react to your kids and
it is.
Give them the right praise or whatever and send the right message. That's hard.
It is. It's really hard. And if, you know, we'll kind of trip up and if we're too nervous about saying the wrong thing all the time, then our kids wonder what's wrong with us because we can't seem to finish a sentence without, you know, backtracking or rephrasing.
So let's talk a little bit about your book. Your most recent book, I have to qualify it. I think I sent this to you in one of my questions as I was looking. I mean, I read this book, The Year My Son and I Were Born, your most recent. Was it published this year in 2010?
The paperback was published in March of 2010, and the hardcover was published a year previous.
Okay. And then I told you I read The Mother and Me, and then I went and looked online and read some of your blogs, kind of just so I could try to understand what other things you've done. And I was telling you that I'm in academia, and so we're supposed to say that we have, like, this cohesive research agenda, and it wouldn't be good if I were to have published things kind of all over the place, you know. So as I was looking, I was thinking, well, I wonder what you would say. Do you feel like you have an agenda, or are there some themes that tie all your work together?
Yes. Yeah, definitely. In fact, you asked about the epigraph to the memoir, the Khalil Gibran quote that introduces the memoir. And I think that sums up perfectly kind of the central theme of everything I do.
Can you read that? Do you have that in front of you?
Yeah, I can quote it to you.
Okay.
It says, your pain is the breaking of the shell which encloses your understanding. And I read that when Thomas was about, it was the summer after he was born, so he was around 9 months old. And it just hit me like few things that have, you know, before or since, that the experiences that I had had with him, as well as the other experiences I've had in my life, which have been most painful, have also contained the seeds of positive change, transformation on a personal level, awareness and understanding, even enlightenment to some degree, that the hardest things, the most difficult things, have also been the most valuable experiences in my life. And so that tends to be a theme in everything that I do.
Okay.
Whether it's writing about disability or depression or Mormon issues, there's always the intent of kind of digging around, digging beneath the surface of human experience to show what it's really like, what does it mean, how does it change you, with ultimately a positive spin that even our most painful experiences that we are reluctant to hold up as blessings mm-hmm. still give us the opportunity to have our hearts opened towards other people. And so there is always a potential benefit and blessing there. Mm-hmm. I feel really strongly about that.
Okay. So is the picture on the front cover of your book, you and Thomas?
Of the paperback, yes.
Uh-huh, it is? Okay. So who would you say then was the audience of your book? As you were imagining writing it, were you thinking, I'm writing this for myself, I'm writing this for these kind of people, or did you even think of that at all?
I did. You know, audience is a central consideration when you're writing, and I had a lot of struggles with that. It was a difficult question. I wanted to write for a national audience. I didn't want the book to be a Down syndrome memoir, per se.
Okay.
I felt like the story of Thomas's diagnosis and what followed that first year is kind of the surface story, but it's not really what the book is about on a meta level.
Okay.
It's about personal transformation. It's about confronting illusions, dealing with the fallout when they crumble, rebuilding yourself, coming to know what is true through difficult experiences. It's not just about having a child with Down syndrome.
Okay.
My publisher, of course, needed a marketing angle.
Okay.
And they have marketed the book as more of a Down syndrome focused book because there is a niche audience there. And so they've emphasized that aspect of the book, which is, you know, perfectly fine. But I do feel that it's written for a much wider audience than parents of kids with Down syndrome.
Okay. Well, yeah, because I don't have a child with Down syndrome, but I was reading on the cover of your book, someone named Margaret Young, who I don't know who that is, said that your book is for anyone coping with a hard surprise.
Yeah.
And I thought, as I was reading it, I kept making notes out in the margin or just, you know, exclamation marks or yes or just little things like that. And I thought, you know, I only have three kids. I mean, I shouldn't say we don't have any shared experiences, but it seems like in a number of ways our lives are pretty different. But I kept thinking throughout the book, oh, yes, I agree with that. And so when I saw that little thing that it was for anyone coping with the hard surprise, I thought, well, there's a lot here that I can relate to, even though our experiences really are different. So it spoke to me on a lot of levels. I'm sure it has with a lot of other people as well.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. That's exactly what I was hoping.
Yes.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to provide feedback, please check us out at mormonstories.org. If you want to help keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider either making a financial contribution or spreading the word about this episode through your blog, Twitter account, Facebook page, family newsletter, or through your ward bulletin and ward newsletter. Just kidding about those last two. Music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton. Check them out at claytonpixton.com or skypixton.com. That's Sky with an E, S-K-Y-E, pixton.com. Thank you.